You're listening to the Yizzy Research Podcast, hosted and created by me, Imani, a researcher. This is the podcast for people who research people. In this episode, I speak with Janelle Ward.
Well, my name is Janelle Ward. I'm currently the principal consultant at my own consultancy called Janelle Ward Insights. I work with companies who really have an interest in expanding their research capabilities, whether that's leveling up their existing research practices or investing for the first time in a formal research team. Now, before I struck out on my own, I was working in-house for several years in UX research leadership roles. I was the founding lead UX researcher at a company called Mendix. There, we introduced research to the company for the first time, and that role rapidly became more of a management role as we grew very rapidly, a team of both researchers and service designers. And I also worked at JustEatTakeaway.com in a hybrid, more of a hybrid lead manager role. And there I was tasked with upskilling and growing a UX research team in logistics. But a huge chunk of my career before all of this was in academia. So after I got a PhD in political communication, I worked as an assistant professor at Erasmus University Rotterdam for more than a decade. And despite the constant references to Netherlands-based institutions, I've been based here for 21 years, but I'm a Minnesota native.
Janelle's going to share some tips, tricks, and strategies to being a great UX research manager. Minnesota native, self-employed. You mentioned when you were giving your introduction that you've done a lot before you got to your current consulting role. You're a former research manager, but you weren't always one. How did you know that you were ready for the responsibility of being a people manager?
That's a really good question. I think a lot of people find themselves in management roles without really feeling that they're ready or knowing that they're ready. For me, my experience was maybe a little bit different in the sense that in academia, the title manager, at least in my department, was only given to someone who was a full professor who could then manage formally other, let's say, assistant professors or associate professors in the department. So it actually took a move into industry for me to realize that for all those years in academia, I actually was a manager, but without the title. So for example, once you've taught a course a couple times or the department grows, you end up managing a team of lecturers. You're kind of in charge of this very large scale course with several hundred students, and you need to manage those lecturers and how the course is run, how to deal with different student problems, and then of course, managing your own students. So I see it kind of managing people, that's one skill, but there's also managing the research craft, and that's also a big part of the academic world. So to answer your question, how do you know you're ready? I think if you have the fortune of having someone really ask you and detail what it's like to be a people manager, and you can think about whether that's a good fit for you or know that you're going to try this out, I think that's a good way to start. But if you just find yourself kind of in it, it's something that you learn, yeah, along the way, how it feels and if you like that kind of responsibility in your work.
Yes. And I need to do a separate episode one day about the academia to UX researcher pipeline.
Yeah.
There are so many times where people have, and also another point you made, there are times when people may be doing a job, in this case, being a people manager, but may not have that formal job title, like you explained when you were working in academia. A huge part of being a people manager is also being a hiring manager. So you have to hire researchers at some point, or you usually hire researchers at some point. How do you create a hiring strategy for growing a UX research team?
Well, that's a great question and a really important one. I think I would say the first time that I hired someone that was still in academia, I realized the huge responsibility you have. I mean, someone could be moving across the world to work on your team, and you really want to make sure they're going to be a good fit as well as you can tell in the hiring process. So that requires really figuring out what you need as well to the best of your ability before bringing them in. So I would say, you know, maybe the obvious thing that comes to mind is creating a job description and starting, you know, the process with recruitment. But actually, before that, I think it's really important to think about the big picture stuff, like what is the vision for research at this company? We can do a whole episode on vision too, but in its essence, vision for research needs to align with business vision. So you cannot create a successful research practice at a company if you're not aligning with the business, because that's why you're there, essentially. And then strategy, you know, in essence, is about executing that vision. And then getting to hiring now, it's about practically where will research sit in this organization? Do we want to, let's say, have an agency model where we have research more centralized? Or do we want our researchers embedded in product teams, for example? Now, you don't always just get to pick what you think is best. You're dealing with a lot of different stakeholders, and you know, people may have strong opinions who are in positions of power, and you might have to go with that. So, but it's important to talk about these things and weigh, you know, the pros and the cons of choosing which model you choose. So basically moving on from that, those discussions that you have with various key stakeholders as you're going to grow that team, then you're thinking about, you know, writing these job descriptions, and you want to hire strategically. So you want to think about a couple things. Two I can mention is, one, what does the seniority of the researcher need to be? And in my experience in low maturity companies, it can be really challenging to hire a junior researcher who is going to need to kind of embed in a product team alone and handle all the things that come along with that, because it isn't just research work. They need to have, if they can have someone next to them really mentoring them and helping them, that can work out. But in my experience, I hired, for example, at Mendix, I hired senior researchers who were capable of kind of going into the product area that they were assigned and kind of doing their thing. You know, of course, I was managing them, and we would discuss challenges that they had and different approaches they were using, but I needed them to be able to do that more or less independently because the team was scaling so fast. So the seniority is one thing, and that depends on kind of how the company looks in terms of its maturity. And then it's also the expertise of the researcher. So what kind of research do we need to be doing in this company? For example, if it's a company has never seen researchers before, and there's no sort of generative research, discovery research on the user's sort of fundamental knowledge of the users, then you're going to need researchers who are really good at this exploratory qualitative research. If you have a company that is really, really keen to get, let's say, data science working together with research, you might want to have someone who's skilled in mixed methods or is a quantitative researcher who can really talk to those people and find a way to collaborate between quantitative and qualitative. So those are some things I think about when I think about creating job descriptions.
So you craft the job description for incoming UX researchers by considering their expertise, and you assess the level of expertise needed by thinking about the research maturity of the company. And you think about the type of research, generative, evaluative, mixed methods, what type of research that needs to be done. So as a next step, now you have your research team, right? What practical steps do you take to build research culture as a manager?
Yeah, that's really, really an important thing, because often researchers find that they're coming in to do something that people might not understand or might have different conceptions of, different than the researchers themselves, and sometimes just kind of varying within the organization. I would say, in my experience, it's super important for, you know, and me and the roles that I had, for example, is to really evangelize to the rest of the company. So what I mean by that is not, you know, walk through the hallways with a poster or stand up in meetings and shout, but really going into meetings and making sure that you're listening to where the problems are, where the challenges are, asking, you know, what are your top priorities? How can we help as researchers? How can we fit in here? And really figuring out where we can contribute as researchers and kind of putting on our research hat and thinking, this is what we could offer from a research perspective. So I think that's huge, because it's not just that you've shown up and people know what you're doing there and know how you can help. A lot of people don't know because they haven't worked with researchers before, or at least in this organization. So it's really important to, I think, start by talking to the non-researchers and, you know, getting yourself sort of out of the comfort of your own team, let's say.
Do you find that it's harder to build a research culture now that a lot of research teams are remote or hybrid, or is it still the same?
Well, in one of my jobs, I started in person. It was before the pandemic. And the second job was done entirely during the pandemic, at least when everyone was still working remote. I think, I mean, in my experience, it was more challenging working from home. I think those organic conversations that would happen in the hall, where I would run into people who probably wouldn't necessarily want to schedule a meeting with me, or, you know, they have other priorities. I'm still not seen as someone they really need to talk to or need to collaborate with. But when I would see them at the coffee machine, I could make a comment, or I could see a meeting going on as I walked by and say, this meeting looks like it's, you know, has a lot of people that I need to talk to. What meeting is this? Maybe I can get into that meeting. So that's a little bit harder to see when you're online, but I think it most definitely can still be done. It's just making those connections. And it's possible to make connections definitely in a remote setting. I'm all for remote work, but I think that if you have the chance at least sometimes to meet people in person, it can be really, really valuable to do that.
Yes, plus one to remote work.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, so we talked about that, like building research culture remotely, in person, hybrid. But in addition to managing people as a UX research manager, you're also doing other things as well. What do you wish direct reports knew about being a research manager?
Mm. Yeah, that's a good one. What do I wish that they knew? Well, I think that, you know, people have had bad experiences with managers, also good experiences. But I think, you know, in my view, if you're a people manager, your people need to be your priority. As a manager, I think you don't realize it to the same extent, but you really are the person who holds the power in this relationship. I mean, that manager, you know, depending on how it works at the company, will have a moment where they're going to evaluate your performance, where they can make a decision about whether you're going to get a bump in salary or whether you're going to get a different job title. And that is really a power position to hold. So I think you really need to hold that with sort of like a humbleness, you know, an awareness of the power dynamic in this relationship. And I think, you know, that said, I think it's really important to build an authentic relationship with your report. So I know I was in the position where I was a peer and then I was a manager, and I had to do that shift between, you know, kind of being their friend or their buddy at work to being this person in this position. And that was tough. And I think the tendency can be to feel like, oh, well, now I need to know everything and I need to be confident about everything. And if I say that I don't know or I'm not sure, then they'll doubt my authority. And I think that was, that it's really a misconception. And I think, you know, it's still challenging for me after all these years to remember that, like, it's okay to say, I don't know, or let me think about that, or let me, you know, puzzle over this for a while. So it's really like authenticity. It's really being authentic in that relationship.
It's also important that you said that as a manager, you would want your direct reports to know that sometimes you don't know. And it sounds like you were saying that your advice for other managers would be to say, would be that it's okay to not always know. And it's okay to say that I don't know. Let me think about that. And when you mentioned that you do other things in addition to managing people, you're also doing your own research too. How is the research you're doing as a manager different than the research you did, different from the research you did as an individual contributor?
Yeah, well, this is something that really I feel, if for anyone out there who's worked in the academic world, who's done, you know, supervision of projects, there's really a lot to be said about being in a management role in UX research or being in a supervisory role in the academic world. So when you're conducting your own research, I mean, it's, let's say, you know, you're the sole researcher on the project and you're sort of like, you own this space. So you need to create things organically, right? You know, you're collaborating with stakeholders, you're figuring out what is actually the research question. I mean, is this something that we can answer with research? Let's craft this. Let's figure out how this fits together, how we can sort of create that research puzzle so the pieces will fit together in the end. And the difference is when you're managing, you're kind of looking at that work secondhand. So someone else is doing that initial creation work and doing the hard work of sort of constructing that project. But then as a manager, you need to be able to come in and draw on that expertise you've had from doing that for so long And then be able to point out and say, oh, this is great. This is really solid. Hey, you know, tell me about this choice right here. You know, maybe we could, you know, include some other people here, or what about this method, or what about this recruitment? So it's much more, yeah, you're overseeing the research, but I think also important for a lot of researchers who find themselves in this kind of hybrid lead manager role is that you can also use the opportunity to mentor your researchers in that process and coach them through that. So let's say you're actually on the project as well, which has happened to me when I was doing both lead and management roles simultaneously, then you're responsible for the project, but you also want to help this researcher sort of upskill themselves. So let's say they need some help in conducting interviews. So you can, you know, have them sit through one interview where you're leading the interview, and then you talk about it afterwards. Like, what did they observe? What questions did they see? Did they have about what they saw or what they heard? And then you can kind of advance that to where they're leading the interview and you're more the observer, and then discuss that. So that's what I love about it, actually, is you can do the work, but you're teaching along the way. And I think that's an important part of being in this sort of more management level with researchers.
Mm-hmm. And as a senior leader, as a manager, who do you turn to when you need career advice or professional support?
Yeah, that is important. I think it's tough because, again, we come back to, but I'm supposed to have all the answers, right? I don't need to ask for advice. You know, when I got into the field, I discovered this podcast. It's no longer running, so it's not a competitor, but it was it's called Dollars to Donuts by Steve Portigal, and he talked to UX research leaders about the challenges they faced in growing research in their companies. And that's exactly what I was going through. Unexpectedly, I didn't expect to land in a role like that. And so I would listen to those podcasts and I would get in touch with a lot of the people I heard on that podcast, because there was almost always something where I thought, this is so compelling, I want to hear more about them from that. So I sort of started to build my network in that way. Now that I'm, you know, running my own consultancy, I have a business coach I talk to about more of the like business related things, which is a completely different different topic as well. But I also have, you know, a lot of people that I have one-on-ones with either weekly or bi-monthly. I mean, we have regular touch points where we sort of connect and talk about the challenges that we have. So I think, you know, you can reach out to people and they ignore you, they don't have time. But there's always going to be someone who responds, and then, you know, you build a connection and they can be incredibly supportive. So I think it's really important to have that because, you have less people to bounce off ideas when you're in a management role.
The best products are built by listening to your customers. But without a great tool, capturing quality insights is nearly impossible. DScout was built to solve this challenge. Whether you're running moderated or unmoderated research, the DScout platform helps you recruit high-quality participants, manage unlimited concurrent studies, and share insights and video clips in minutes. Stop overpaying for questionable research. Instead, partner with DScout, the company trusted by Spotify, Lululemon, Google, and more. Visit dscout.com for all the tools you need to boost your insights program. You mentioned podcasts, reaching out to people you heard on the podcast, having a business coach. That's more for the business side of what you do. So you created a support system for yourself to, like you said, to have people to bounce ideas off of, to maintain a high morale for yourself, because I'm sure that can be difficult when you're self-employed. And as a follow-up to that, how do you cultivate high morale for a team of direct reports with different seniority levels and employment types, let's say remote, hybrid, in person?
I mean, it's important, you know, it's this team aspect. And I don't think in my experience, it's been really challenging to sort of enforce, or not enforce, that's not the right word, to sort of foster that team feeling, because, you know, so many researchers are on their own for a long time. And then if they get a buddy or a couple buddies, it can feel really empowering to have that connection. I think with this happened in academia too, people feel maybe insecure about certain skills they have. But again, it's sort of fostering this culture of let's be authentic and let's be vulnerable about what we still need to know and what we can teach each other. So for example, you know, my background, I mean, I'm I consider myself a research expert, but I haven't been in UX research as long. So there are some specifics about UX research that I'm just not as familiar with. And I can ask others to, you know, help me if I have a question, whereas they might have questions, you know, about the research process that I can better answer because of my expertise. So I think it's really just recognizing that everyone brings different strengths to the table. And it's good to ask for help. It's good to turn to each other and kind of use that team as a place where, hey, we're all researchers and we can sort of bond together on the challenges we're facing. I haven't dealt with working in a team where some are remote and some are in person, so I can't answer that as much. I think that would definitely potentially be challenging. I mean, what I've heard that I really like the sound of, and you know, and also some of my people that I coach have mentioned, is even if they're working remote or some people are less in the office, there's a period where they can get together for a few days and really kind of bond, even if it's online, but it's really sort of team building time. So I think that's important no matter where you are.
I have a hypothetical scenario for you that I want to run past you. Sure. Let's say that one of your direct reports is sharing research deliverables that are low quality and you have to share that feedback with them. How do you approach that conversation?
That can be a really tough situation. You know, I mean, it depends on where this came from. It shouldn't be something that comes out of nowhere, right? I mean, if I'm in the position where I've hired someone and they've gone through the process and I've watched, you know, I've assessed their research expertise in the interview, but I've also assessed how they interact with the stakeholders. I mean, normally if it's clear where this researcher will be working, I bring those key stakeholders into the interview process so I can already observe the dynamics between them, those initial dynamics. So it shouldn't particularly be something that comes out of nowhere. And I mean, that can happen if you come into a job with an existing team and you didn't get all the information that you should have, either because you didn't ask or they didn't tell you or a combination of both. That can happen. And we can talk about that later if we talk about coming into an existing research team as a manager. But I would say, you know, people, like researchers, are smart, introspective people. And I think I always start by asking how they feel about, you know, the work they're doing or the thing, the presentation, in this case, if it was a deliverable, a presentation or whatever form it took, I ask them first what they think about it. And I would say 99% of the time they can identify already where they don't feel like it went well or they think they could improve. So, I mean, that's really where I start, is, you know, with their assessment of it. And of course, if they don't identify that, I can give them more direct feedback. But I will say, even if I am not hiring that person or this has kind of come out from nowhere, one way that this has gone more smoothly for me is that when I first start with someone on my team, one of the first things I do is I have them fill out these questions. I got this from this book. It's by Lara Hogan. It's called Resilient Management. And she has these kind of questions for the first one-on-one, and they're so great. And they're about, you know, how do I know when you're grumpy? I love that question. But they also are questions about how do you like to receive feedback? When do you like to receive it? In the moment, in front of other people, privately? Do you prefer to have a one-on-one conversation? Do you prefer to hear it on Slack? And so you get to discuss this in a hypothetical way before you get to the moment where there can be this, you know, kind of charged situation where you're saying this didn't go well. So at least you know the form that you can take with this person so it will be best received. And I think that helps just to kind of, yeah, clear the way. So you're not only giving bad feedback, but also giving bad feedback in a way that they're going to respond negatively too, because you've already learned that about them.
I love that. Level setting before you actually start to formally manage them. And again, the name of that book was Resilient Management by Lara Hogan, and that's Lara Hogan. I'm gonna have to look that one up. I'm not a manager, but I like that. What she mentioned about the first, she gave some suggestions about having the first one-on-one, and you said one of the questions was something to the effect of, how do I know that you're grumpy, or what makes you grumpy?
I think it's, how will I know when you're grumpy? Like, mm-hmm. how do you act when you're grumpy? mm-hmm.
That I do like that. It's a serious question, but it's also kind of a fun question too. Mm-hmm. Like, especially if you're coming into an existing team, it's a good way to break the ice. It's a fun question, but it's a serious and direct question too. And I also think that asking those types of questions shows that you care about your direct report. You care about how they feel. I'm enough to ask, what does it look like when you feel a certain way? Because you can't always tell how someone feels. Yeah, I think it shows that you actually care about getting to know them and working with them in a way that makes sense for their personality.
Yeah, I totally agree. I absolutely love it. It's gone over really well when I've asked people to fill this out. And yeah, it's like we're all grumpy at work at some point. But it sort of softens the way that we feel a bit. I mean, I don't know if I would always describe it as grumpy, but it also gives you some self-awareness, like, oh, yeah, I do that when I'm grumpy. And now my manager is going to know. So I'm going to have to talk about this, you know? So it's a really nice sort of, yeah, tone to set from the beginning.
And speaking of setting tone, how do you manage conflict between direct reports in a way that's fair and reasonable?
Yeah, I haven't had that. Trying to think of an example. I don't think I've had direct reports have big conflicts with each other, maybe more minor things. I think for me, the conflict has been more with stakeholders and dealing with negotiating, you know, how we're going to do this research, how long it's going to take, what their role is. I mean, I would say in whatever the setting is, I mean, I'm all for transparent communication. So I think a lot of times, you know, you're venting and you're telling someone about something that happened with someone. And it's like, well, okay, this is your side of the story, you know, I'll talk to the other person. But I think the important thing is always to get them eventually to speak directly to each other to work it out. Yeah. I mean, I don't have a fancy framework for this, but I think at the end of the day, that's it. Because yeah, at the end of the day, if I'm just hearing both sides and that's the end of it, it won't resolve the conflict. They need to resolve it with each other if it's a mutual thing.
Yeah, I touched on this indirectly when you were answering some of the other questions I asked. What advice do you have for UX research managers who are inheriting existing UX research teams?
It's important to find out the kind of situation that you're getting into, right? I mean, I'm not saying, oh, if everything isn't perfect, I'm going to decline this job. I don't think that's it at all. I think every team has its challenges, and it's kind of in everyone's best interest for both the incoming manager and the existing teams to kind of be on the same page when that person gets on board. So I would say, this is something, I mean, you're drawing on your research skills in your interview process. And it's important to ask those kind of, you know, probing questions, let's say to the person who's managing the researchers currently, for example. It could be the person you're replacing. They might be getting another job. They might be getting promoted. But, you know, asking them really, you know, what is sort of, which researchers are struggling, if any, you know, how are they feeling about how this team is going? Are there, you know, conflicts that they can talk about at this stage? And some of that can be a bit tricky in the interview stage, but I think, you know, a lot of things can be said at that point without sort of revealing confidential information. Another big one is, you know, let's talk about difficult stakeholder relationships. You know, is the person that you're replacing leaving because they've just had it with someone? And, you know, I mean, there again are ways to say this diplomatically, but maybe you won't have the same problems as they do, right? I mean, we all have different triggers with certain people, you know, like the incoming person could be just fine with that person, but it's important to know what the challenges are. I think a really good one is to ask about when there was a conflict, kind of like you're asking me now. Tell me about a time there was a conflict between, you know, research and product or within research. You know, how did that go? How is it resolved? What's the status today? I think that's really important to kind of get into those questions that make you as well feel a little bit uncomfortable. But if you don't ask those questions, you know, now, and then you're in a job for 3 months and suddenly you're really surprised, like, why didn't they tell me this? Well, they're not always going to tell you. You need to figure out what questions you need to ask to kind of find yourself in an environment where you can thrive. So if you learn, for example, that, you know, certain behaviors are just, you don't do well in that kind of environment, and that really seems to be the kind of place this is, maybe it isn't the right fit for you. But the only way to find out that information is to ask in the interview.
Also, what you're getting at too is that conflict management or conflict resolution, peacekeeping, those are all skills. And just because you're a manager, it doesn't always mean that you have fully developed those skills yet. Even if you're not a manager, it takes time to figure out how to resolve conflict. And it is awkward, especially trying to maintain your dignity and trying to be diplomatic. If you're working with someone, if your issue may be with the other person that they may not be, it's hard. It's not easy to figure out how to engage with them. and it definitely, it's a skill for non-managers as well.
Yeah. And I think, you know, people find themselves in work situations where they think, if I would have known this, don't think I would have taken this job. And I mean, I've heard this from, you know, the people that I coach now, and it's like, okay, that's okay. You know, let's deal with the situation the way it is, but let's use this. Like, this is a learning, right? This is a learning that you have learned about yourself, that this is a situation you don't like. This is an environment you don't want to be in. So let's think about the kind of questions you can ask in your next job interview to identify this as best you can. And so you know more about what you want. I mean, often we find out what we need and what we want by experiencing the opposite. So it's not the end of the world and a terrible outcome. It's actually only terrible if you don't learn anything and you end up in the same situation because you didn't take any steps to improve it. So I think it's really just a really normal learning in a professional career.
Exactly. I think a lot of adults, a lot of people I've spoken to who are even more senior than me, they seem to also struggle with confrontation as well, or being assertive at work being assertive without being combative. That's hard for people to do. For me, I found that keeping a work journal is something I started doing years ago. So for each job I have, I just keep a Google Doc for the job. And then every time I feel like I have something just to write down in that journal, I'll type it up. I'll put the date and I'll just type out whatever happened that day, what I'm thinking. That can also be a good way to help organize your thoughts. It can be a good way to help you visualize scenarios, role-playing to actually have conversations with people. That's been helpful for me as well. For people who are looking for more practical ways to approach this too. If you don't always have a coach, or if you don't have a manager, if you're self-employed dealing with a client, that may be a good idea for people listening too, is to keep a work journal. I don't know, do you keep something similar to that?
Yeah, well, that is such a great idea. I do something similar now. Yeah, I've tried a couple different kinds of journaling, and actually what I do end up doing is always saying, oh, I'm going to write an article about this. So I have it all there. It's just not in a journal. It's in a draft article. But I think that's such excellent advice. I mean, it can be so therapeutic to write it down, but it can also be really useful when you find yourself at a crossroads. Like, okay, you know, am I going into a new job now? And what do I need to remember about this job that I can bring forward? And if you don't write it down, you might forget. And then suddenly you'll be in your new job and you'll say, oh, I totally forgot. I should have asked about this. Or, you know, I forgot that I decided I wanted to go in a slightly different direction. So I think that's really great advice. And yeah, I'm always writing. So I definitely recommend it.
Yes, you write a lot of great articles. For people who are curious, if you Google Dr. Janelle Ward, you will see a ton of articles that actually helped me when I was trying to break into UX research. So yes. And also as a follow-up for that, with the work journal idea, it doesn't always have to be about solution finding. Like, it can be, but it can also just be about just processing. Maybe you just had a poor presentation, or you had to interact with someone who was very disrespectful. You don't always have to find solutions, at least for me. Sometimes I just use that space just to process what happened, just to write down how I'm feeling, how I responded to it. Do I need to follow up? Should I get other people involved? Right? It can also just be a place just to process and think. And not always a place for solution finding too.
Yes, totally agreed. And I thought of something else when you said that, is sometimes for years I've had this tendency to write out a very, you know, cutting email about something that I was very frustrated about. And then of course you never send it, but you have that version of it. And it feels really good. And then you, you know, take a night of sleep and come back to it and then write it in a very different way. But the writing of it and really expressing your emotion can be, you know, really therapeutic too, just to get it out.
Absolutely. And also that exercise with the email. So I've done that many times where I've written a sharp email and I would send it to myself though, just for the sake of mentally just sending it to someone. Mm-hmm. And then I either just wouldn't email the actual person or I'll send a very differently toned email to the actual person in real life. So that can be another exercise mm-hmm. too, in addition to doing a work journal, is sending yourself the email and writing it in the way that you wish you could write it, like, and don't hold back, just as a way to process again. And there's something psychological about hitting the send button, although it's coming back to you, that can help you process as well. So
I'm going to remember that one.
Yes. Janelle's like, I'm going to lock that one away. And then, yeah, that was really good. A good chat about like journaling and writing and processing.
Yeah.
And my final question for you, what advice do you have for researchers interested in applying for UX research manager roles?
This is a good one. I actually did it's an article too. It's called How to Thrive as a UX Research Manager. So I could, that's a 15 minute read. So if you're interested in my long form answer, you can check that out. But I think, you know, the essence of that article and that it was also a talk is really ask yourself why you want to be a manager. I mean, the thing about management is that, you know, a lot of the times it's billed to us as, hey, this is a step up. This is a promotion. Of course, you're going to take the role if you're offered it, you know, or you go for it and you get a job offer because it's a step up in your career. But the thing is that it's also a completely different set of responsibilities. So for me, it's really, you know, it's about the people you're going to be managing. You are now responsible for other people. You're responsible for, you know, how they experience their daily work life. I mean, like we were talking about earlier, this power position. You aren't just showing up every day at work for yourself. You know, it's a really challenging place to be in if you aren't so interested in mentoring and coaching and helping people in their careers. It's really a different focus than doing IC work. Of course, a lot of ICs are also mentoring and that's how they learn that they would like to get more into management. But they really, I think it's important for people to ask themselves why. Just thinking about how taking on that role can also impact your team members. And that's really a vital responsibility to have.
I have a follow-up. I know I said that was the last question, but you made me think about something. How do managers define the boundary between what they're responsible for as a manager and what their direct report is responsible for? So let's say if their direct report isn't having a good experience at the job, how much of that is on the direct report and how much of that is on the manager trying to help them figure out, the manager trying to help them navigate the environment?
Yeah, this is where I might be a little more unconventional in that I think it's really important to go through this taboo with your report that, like, you're here in this job and we're never going to talk about the fact that you're going to leave this job. You're just here indefinitely. And that's, you know, kind of the premise of what we're doing. I don't want that premise. I want the premise being this is one step on a long career you're going to have. And probably most likely with the tenure that a lot of us have, it's not going to be the last job you have. It's not going to be the last company you work for. So I think putting that out there can be such a sigh of relief. And then that makes the ability to manage so much broader and so much more sort of holistically based on what that person needs. So when someone is struggling in a role, if there's a challenge that they're facing, I mean, we also, I do dream like career goal work with my reports too in the beginning of our relationship. And so it's like, okay, this thing that you're struggling with right now, you know, let's look big picture. What is this teaching you? You know, what are you learning? Is this a skill you want to develop to get where you want to be, you know, in 5 years and 10 years? Or is this just, you know, something that's really a challenge that you just know you never want to do it again? Well, then you need to decide, like, is this so, you know, unbearable that you don't want to be a part of this? Well, then, you know, maybe it is time for you to go, you know, based on the decision that they make. But that hasn't happened to me. I mean, what I think when people are able to sort of zoom out from whatever challenge is really, you know, taking over their mind at the moment, and think about how it's playing a role in getting to them to where they want to be. It's like, okay, I don't like this, but if I learn to deal with situations like this, I'm going to be able to move into the kind of role that I want. So I think that can really help. Yeah, I hope that answers your question.
It does. It sounds like you're a great manager. Like, I like that, what you said about having like a conversation with your direct reports early on about career pathing beyond the company and role, understanding that the role that they are working in with you is just a step in their career. I think that requires a lot of maturity and practicality on the part of you as a manager, because a lot of managers don't get that. They behave as if the person is there forever. So I think that you having those initial conversations, it makes your direct reports psychologically safe to say things like, you know what, I don't like this part of my job, or they may feel more comfortable telling you that, hey, I started looking for another job, or putting in that notice with you as well, because you made them feel like, okay, well, you get that they're going to leave at some point.
Yeah, I hope so. It's what I would want from a manager as well. That's kind of how I look at it. Like, this is how I would want to be treated by my manager too.
Thanks for listening to the Yizzy Research Podcast, the podcast for people who research people. I'm Imani, the host and creator. Visit yizzyresearch.com for podcast show notes and information about my UX research coaching program. Again, that's yizzyresearch.com, Y-Z-Z-I, research.com. This podcast was produced by Whisper and Mutter.